Great. Thank you, Monica. So it is January 21st, 2025. Actually, what I didn't mention in my little prelude was that I had to cancel my trip to San Diego. I was supposed to be in San Diego this weekend and was really looking forward to being down there to do some teaching and hanging out with some friends. And as the day approached, my health made it clear that it wouldn't be practical, and I'm grateful that I didn't attempt that. So in any case, I am here, I am breathing, and when my breathing gets explosive in the form of coughing, we have a mute button, which is a lovely thing. Don't we wish we had mute buttons everywhere in the world? So let's begin with some sitting and just settling back. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And beginning by just turning the attention to the body. The overall sense of the body, your posture, how you're holding and aligning the body. You can take time to configure, rebalance if that's helpful at the beginning of a sit. Just having a sense of settling. Here you are. What's going on inside? Energetically, emotionally, mentally. Can it all settle? Can you have a sense of releasing tension in the body, allowing feelings to be there without grasping or pushing away, without fear? Each moment presents us with a different self, different sensations, different feelings, different thoughts. With mindfulness, take a step back, in a sense, to just allow all this to come and go without being disturbed. It's okay. Even the inner chaos is okay. Even as we might have a perspective of broadening and stepping back, there's also a stepping forward, a holding, touching. Intimacy with the breath, with the body. With the frailty of life. Moment by moment. Each breath, another extension of this life. Breathing in the energy of oxygen. Breathing out that which the body can't use. Releasing carbon dioxide. Cleansing. Ongoing process. Take for granted. All the rest of our life depends upon this continuous respiration. We live as though it's everything else that is our life, our thoughts, our dreams, all our activities, our doings. And we forget until our breath is threatened. That all of that is dependent upon breathing in and breathing out. We expect our body, our lungs, our heart to just do their job. Very little appreciation. It's second by second, breath by breath, beat by beat. They work to make all the rest of our life possible. If any one of us was asked to do a labor like this 24 hours a day, we would give up in exhaustion quickly. So to bring mindfulness to the breath, to just touch it, to feel it, to know it, is to be aware of life, is to appreciate life as it is, as it continues on. Letting the nervous system settle, releasing persistent thoughts, returning to the breath, to the body, to the present moment, trusting in this process of letting go. All right. So, for those who are sort of new to this, like we'll call the class, I don't give, I typically don't give just straightforward meditation instructions, like step by step, some a little bit, but because this has been going ongoing for 5 years, every week I kind of branch off, but into little explorations. So, but there's a lot of instruction out there for you can find, even on my website, probably. I'm gonna blow my nose. I'm gonna pause for a moment. I mean, not pause, I'm gonna mute. So I actually, before my own sitting this morning, I was looking from at something from Ajahn Pasno, traditional Buddhist teaching, and I'll get into that. But I thought I would talk a little bit about a few experiences I had over the past week. I bet some of you are sick. Karen, you look all bundled up like somebody who's sick. But yeah, so maybe it's useful, but for me it's interesting. I do as best I can try to bring my principles of mindfulness and compassion, wisdom to my experiences, whatever they are. And I'm not perfect at that by any means, but last week, and actually particularly Tuesday and Wednesday nights, were particularly difficult, and getting to a state where I'm coughing for 20 or 30 minutes in the middle of the night, and it's so intense and uncomfortable that I start to feel desperate, and found myself like two things came up that will be familiar to you. God, which was like, oh shit, like I'm like, no, because I don't believe that I can ask God to do anything for me. And that's, in a way, I wish I could, I wish that I thought that was. So that was like, oh boy, I'm really in bad shape if I'm like wanting God. And then death, it's like, this is so fucking bad. I just want to be dead right now. And then realizing like it just stopped after like 20 or 30. It was like, it was just a little bit of time. You know what I mean? It's like, it just so interesting how pain is. I think about, you see these movies, people being tortured all the time. If you watch spy movies and the kind of stuff that. And I'm always like, no, like as soon as they like even like get ready to do anything, I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever you want to know. Like, I just, maybe I'm just like I don't have a strong character, but when everything starts to go bad, I just go down the tube so quickly, and really just kind of embarrassing. You know what I mean? Like, I'm supposed to be like a Buddhist in recovery, and I'm like, give me some heroin or something, which not that, but that just helped me, let me out of here. That's interesting to me, is just to see kind of the edge that we live in. We just like normality seems like, oh yeah, sure, of course. But one thing, it doesn't take much, like 20 or 30 minutes of coughing, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not talking about being, tied up and tased or something. I'm just like sick. So that's interesting to me. And of course, not, just to state the obvious, it reminds me a lot of hitting bottom as an addict, and the desperation, that sense of desperation. And I'm grateful that it's not that, there's just a bronchitis or whatever. But some other moments that were maybe more inspiring My wife drove me to for a chest X-ray, which was like my chest is in is was fine. Turned out, I'm not dying. Don't have pneumonia. Don't have cancer. But right, I'm not used to just riding in the car because I usually drive, and so I was like, I'm riding in the back seat because I'm like, I don't even want to like look out, and looking out the window, driving through Berkeley, and it's like looking at the trees, and then like going by a playground, and I go, I said to my wife, I'm having a spiritual experience. I was in an altered state, and it was like that magic of like life, and you're just seeing it, and you're just like present. Yeah, it was beautiful, and it just was so striking again that these moments just appear out of. And it's, yeah, of course, it's because I'm, as I say, in an altered state. I mean, physically in a strange, mentally and physically in a strange place. But, that's there, that veil can be pierced very easily, again, very simple. And then returning once again to like, oh, I'm in the back of a car, this sucks. And then finally, the experience of the emergency room, which of course, it's the last place. You only go there when you're like, oh man, and you walk in, you're like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have even come here. It'll seem really crowded and like sort of chaotic, but it actually was really well run, and I was well taken care of. But it's the looking at the dukkha, seeing the people around, and the young woman attached to a saline drip with their mother, and the old man and the wrapped up in a blanket in a wheelchair, and homeless guy kind of bouncing around like hyperactive, and it's if you want to practice seeing the first noble truth of suffering. A great place to go and to see what your heart does with that. Can you be present, and and then I'm feeling bad, of course, and you're and so to be there, of course, is a great antidote to self-pity, right? It's like, oh well, I'm sick, but but that also feels a little like, well, thank God I'm not them. It's like, well, that's not really how I want to view the world. So it's that being able to have my heart open and care about others, and see suffering, and be touched and not be overwhelmed, and also not to pull away from it. So, in any case, the kind of the treatment and advice I got, I think helped. And mainly just to be told, like, you just got this thing that's very stubborn, and you just have to hang in. So, because definitely fear has been a strong factor when in certain states, certain physical states, like, oh no, does this mean? And it's just so interesting, right? What the mind does, this disease, and what's that? Or the unknown. And having someone kind of reassure you, like, yeah, you're this is actually a lot of people have this, and it's like, oh, okay, I'm not dying, I'm not, he was not being born is busy dying, as Bob Dylan said, but in the specific sense, traditional sense, I'm not dying. Okay, dear ones, thank you for No, by looking at the numbers, it doesn't look like anybody left while I was saying all that. So that's encouraging. Like I said, I mean, I think I know what my job is, but I'm not always clear about how to execute it to the best of my ability. So I was looking. This little, tiny little book by Ajahn Pasano called Nourishing the Roots. I've been, the first chapter is like 9 pages long. Been coming back to it multiple times in the last few weeks. So he starts talking about the four foundations of mindfulness. And I thought this was worth looking at, and then going over to the sutta on the four foundations of mindfulness. That's right at the end of this chapter, the first chapter. What are these four foundations of mindfulness for? And what is mindfulness anyway? Especially these days, there's a lot of complications around the expression of mindfulness. Whenever the Buddha talks about mindfulness, he always talks about it with four particular qualities. In the Pali, they are atapi, sampajano, satimā, and vinaya loke abhijadomanasam. I'm going to go to the sutta in a minute and give you the English on this, but it says atapi, and I don't know if that's the right pronunciation. Atapi is ardent. There's an effort there. It's not just passive. It's not passive, just vegging out mindfulness. There's some application. That's, I think, an important thing to reflect on, that it can easily be this sort of just spacing out. One needs to put forth a bit of effort. But again, even when we think of right effort in the Noble Eightfold Path, it's always about wholesome and unwholesome mental states. It's not necessarily about how spectacular it looks on the outside, or how energetic it appears, or how much flailing around one does. It's about the quality of the heart. Increasing wholesome qualities and decreasing the unwholesome qualities. That's the purpose of right effort. Atapi is application, being ardent. Sampajano means clearly comprehending. A part of clear comprehension is that sense of how our actions of body, speech, and mind affect ourselves and affect others. Clear comprehension of seeing how that plays itself out. Satima is possessed of mindfulness, being aware, being alert, being present. The last quality, and this is one I can't pronounce, but I'll try. Vinaya loke abhijada domanasam means pulling back from the habit of liking and disliking, wanting and not wanting, approving and not approving. We bounce around with our likes and our dislikes, the sense of should be or shouldn't be, and keep spinning around. Mindfulness is the ability to have balance, to not be pulled in, the willingness to relinquish or let go of the positions we tend to take. We tend to invest in our positions, liking and disliking, right and wrong, good and bad. We take a stand on them, and we tend to suffer accordingly, usually sharing it out as well. So we seek a balance, a sense of balance in our practice, purifying the very starting point of wholesome states, then put our attention on these four foundations of mindfulness. The Buddha said that if we do that, we will reap only that which is wholesome and skillful. That is the fruit, that is the result. So just to go to these four that he's referring to, this is from the Satipatthana Sutta, which is number 10 in the Majjhima Nikaya, and it's translated as the foundations of mindfulness, or the four foundations of mindfulness. And this is when he first introduces the four foundations of mindfulness. What are the four? Here, monks, a monk abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. So those are the four qualities that Much impossible is referring to ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. So ardent is the top E, and that's where he's talking about effort. Fully aware is sampajano, the clear comprehension, sort of a broad awareness. And mindful is satima. And then the last quality, he says, means pulling back that from the habit of liking and disliking, right? Wanting and not wanting. And in the sutta, it says, having put away covetousness, wanting stuff, and grief for the world. So, and then this gets repeated. One abides contemplating feelings as feelings, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. One abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. One abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. You know, it's I mean, once again, you know, I've read this many, many times. And, you know, something like what Ajahn Pasano gives us, I think is much more helpful than this text of the sutta, which is somewhat vague. I mean, some of it's clear, okay, being ardent and fully aware and mindful. Having put away covetousness and grief in the world is a little vague. I have someone point out that it's basically about liking and not liking. But then, as many of you are aware, as we're contemplating the body, these four foundations is where I think it becomes somewhat confusing. Contemplating the body, okay, pretty clear. Feelings. Well, we know that there's, you know, a specific meaning of that in the suttas, and it's not that it not something that most of us really relate to until we really study it. Mindful of mind, contemplating mind, this becomes start like, well, not sure what that means, right? And then mind objects, it's like, okay, now we're just like into this technical language, right? And so it's helpful, I think, to have people like Ajahn Pasano who kind of break it down a little bit and make it a little bit more accessible. I'm a bit running out of air. So, I'm going to stop talking for a little while and let you guys chime in. I hope that was understandable what I meant by that. Gabrielle.
Okay, hi. Thank you so much for the meditation and for this for the teaching that you just shared. Both of them brought up in me. I've only been attending happily since the 29th when you did your day-long with Spirit Box, so I'm very grateful because, as I mentioned once before, I've been having some slippage with some marijuana issues. I've been sober for 37 years, but the occasional puff has entered my life again, and I'm working on stopping that, and I've been pretty successful in the past couple of weeks. But what came up today was trying to understand the difference between craving and attachment. And I seem to be attached at some level to the idea of a self who identifies as an alcoholic addict. And so when the afternoon craving comes up, it almost seems like a natural default because that's who I really am. So there's some shame sort of thing I think that's clouding it. But I was just wondering if you had anything to say about the difference between craving and attachment. Thank you. And I hope you feel better.
Thanks. Maybe I'm not at my sharpest. So I can't say that anything immediately comes up. I mean, obviously there's a difference. I guess fundamentally I think of attachment as being more mental and craving as being more physical, in the sense that, it's the craving tends to be a sense oriented, or oriented towards sense experience. Attachment, as you're describing it, like around identity, but really, it implies as well a craving, a wanting to hold on. But as far as, just it seems like what you're saying is that you're using your belief, I'll say that your belief in this idea of being an addict as an excuse, if you'll pardon my saying that, to behave as an addict, and that's not the purpose of identifying as an addict, if I to state the obvious, and the I think one critical idea in recovery is that we actually do have a choice, and I think that sometimes the language of the 12 steps, talking about powerlessness particularly, implies that we don't have a choice. I believe that what the powerlessness refers to actually, and does apply to your question, it applies to the craving, in that it's that we are powerless over craving arising, and I can say particularly we're powerless over the results of using, the destructive results. But it absolutely does not imply that we are powerless over our choices and our actions that we make around it. And so, as much as there's sort of this de-emphasis and even suggestion that willpower is shouldn't be involved or can't be involved or doesn't work, it seems that, I mean, to me, it seems that will is certainly involved in this. And now, that doesn't mean that it's a simple case of I have to fight against and overcome with my will, my craving. What is really suggested, and as I understand it again, this process of recovery is one in which not so much that we try to face and fight against craving, but rather that we try to cultivate the conditions out of which craving won't arise. And so that's what a program and meetings and the kind of engagement, the kind of daily, one day at a time, which one day at a time doesn't just mean, oh, you'll only have to deal with today, it also means you really need to deal with today. Do everything you can today. Don't put off to tomorrow, like, oh, I'll go to a meeting tomorrow kind of thing. It's like, no, you need to, we need to, if our craving is persistent and daily, then we need to do things that reduce our craving on a daily basis. And so, yes, getting up in the morning and, meditating and eating well, getting rest, exercising, but also working, doing the work, and avoiding the circumstances that make that possible. Not having the substances around. Not if you know that there are times of day, and you just said there were, that craving arises. Very specifically, planning your day around that so that that opportunity won't arise, so that you always have like a meeting or a coffee with a friend or something that happens at that time, so that you can get through it. Because one of the key aspects of reducing craving is not repeating the activity. The more we act on something, the more we build the tendency to do that. That's cause and effect. That's basic rules of karma. And so the opposite is also true. The less we do something, the less we tend to do it. And there's the famous teaching from the Buddha, whatever we think and ponder upon repeatedly, that will become the habit of mind. Well, it's also true that whatever we do act on repeatedly, that will become the habit of body. And so the less we do it, then the craving weakens. So again, it's not about confronting straight on the craving, but taking on things that will undermine it in a as a you know in it, so so that you're not put in that position of having to face craving. Once craving arises in any strong sense, it's very difficult. This idea that, like, oh, I was going to go to the bar, but I was on my way to the bar, but I called my sponsor. It's like, whoever does that? Once you're on the way to the bar, you're like, once you've got the pipe out or whatever it is, however you're ingesting your marijuana, it's like it's too late, right? So you need to do all the things that reduce the likelihood of that happening. Now, that is Kevin's advice for today. Thank you. And hello, hello.
You're on mute, Anne. We can't hear you.
Hi. I was just sending my love and compassion to you, Kevin, about your being ill, and I hope you feel better soon. I was just thinking in response to Gabrielle, and I just wanted to thank her. Thank you, Gabrielle, for such a great question. We all struggle with craving just on different levels, right? On different objects. And I don't know if this might be useful to you, but there's surfing the urge, this idea of, we just spoke about mindfulness. Kevin read the passage from the book, and applying those attributes of mindfulness to the craving when you're ready, when you feel your, practice is strong, or actually, I'm happy to help you with that if you want. Anyway, so it's something that was developed in mindfulness-based relapse prevention, Surfing the Urge, but was really also developed by Judson Brewer, who wrote a book called Craving to Quit. And he describes it in that book. And during COVID, Kevin read from the book, Craving to Quit. He did his research on smoking. People who are smoking. And what he found was, like, most people, when they were given the instruction, okay, smoke, be mindful, really feel it. What does it feel like in the body? What does it feel like, the craving, be, you know, the sort of like tracing back the craving from the beginning point through to its end. And people were very disillusioned, disenchanted by smoking, and they quit. A lot of them, majority of them. So anyway, I just thought I'd offer that. I don't know if it's just another way to apply our practice in the world. And yeah, that's all. Thanks. I think Kevin, you're muted.
Well, there you go. Thank you.
Yeah.
Just to say that those who don't know Anne, she is a full-fledged Dharma teacher who leads a group at Insight Santa Cruz, and she's going to be one of the teachers on the retreat at the end of February. So she's not speaking from a lack of knowledge and experience. Thank you, Anne. And you know what? One of the things that really stuck with me from Judd's book is the 10 minutes. He says that craving for cigarettes lasts for 10 minutes. And if you can surf the urge, as Anne says, for that 10 minutes, that you'll find that it passes. You know, so remembering impermanence is a useful thing, you know. What retreat in February? I don't think we should tell people. I think we should keep that secret. It might be somewhere in the previous chat stuff. I don't know. Anyway, is it on the front page of my website? Who knows? Anyway, yes, there's a retreat in Northern California.
I put it on the chat.
All right, I knew you're on top of it. Yeah, it's also on the front page of my website, kevingriffin.net. I still have December 29th on there, but you know, maybe I'm not totally on top of my website. Julie, hello.
Hello, everybody. I'm glad to be here, Kevin. I sure hope you feel better. Let me see, I'm on my phone and I'm not fluent in doing this by phone. Okay. Thank you for your offerings today. A couple things come to mind. Number one, and you know, I always seem to be contrarian and I don't mean to come across that way, but I don't think at all the issue is liking or disliking. We all have preferences. If we're engaged Buddhists, we vote, we care about things. If we're, you know, in recovery, then we like, you know, we prefer sobriety over not being sober. It's attachment. It's the attachment to the like, and it's the keep liking and keep disliking in the face of what truth is unfolding. So I don't think it's the liking or disliking or having preference. I think it's the attachment to the preference that can be problematic. So that's one thing that arises when I hear this teaching. And the other is something you touched on. It's something I've been trying to explore. No one will play with me. So I think what I understood is in alignment with what I have discovered in my explorations, and that is around powerlessness. And I think that in 12-step recovery, powerless does tend to refer to powerless over choice, powerlessness over choice. And I don't agree with that. That's just my personal experience. I'm not talking about the program or anybody else's experience. But if I were powerless over choice, then I'm equally powerless to make the choice to turn my life and will over to the care of a higher power, which I am, by the way, unable to do that. And I'm unable to make healthy decisions consistently with food. But the choice to me is the same. The choice to align my words, actions, behaviors, intentions with a higher power is the same choice to refrain from eating ingredients or volume that are not helpful and healthy for me. It is exactly the same choice. It is a different framing, but it's the same choice. So anyway, I've been playing with that, And when I thought I heard you said that powerlessness does not mean powerlessness over choice. And so that resonated with me. And if I misunderstood you, then I appreciate hearing it my way. Thank you all, and thank you all for listening.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Julie. I don't have a answer to that question. Not sure. Unfortunately, I'm sorry. I just don't have a useful response. I am struggling. Just no, I'm not struggling to breathe. I'm breathing okay. It's just that talking a lot is. Takes away a lot of the breath. Steve, go ahead.
I'm here to help you with
Oh, okay.
that. boy, I know I great compassion for what you're experiencing, for sure. I really felt just this deep connection first when the class started, when you were talking about what we're going through right now as a community, as a nation, dealing with what's going on in the world. And the first thing that came into my consciousness was seeing Elon Musk with his Nazi raising his hand like that, and it just the fear that just shot through my body this morning, and experiencing some of the, I mean, day one was like, oh my God, what are we up against? And one could speak volumes on how we got here and what's going on and how, but how are we going to deal with it is, you're spot on when you talk about meditation. I've been sitting for an hour and a half just because I have to, to deal with what's going on. So, yeah, I just have this tremendous compassion for what you're experiencing, and that panic of not being able to breathe, and how are we going to deal with the chaos that's about to come before us all as a community and as meditators, and trying to live our lives with metta. That's kind of what I'm focused on when Martin Luther King talks about, learning to love those that are enemies and the people that we don't agree with or that we don't care about. It's very challenging. So, I just figured I'd step in and maybe say a few things to give you an opportunity to get your breath back. You know how much I love you and how much you've helped me in my life with my things, and I'm so looking forward to the retreat for sure. But yeah, we're all faced with some very, very critical situations coming up before us, So anyway, I'm here to support you in any way I can. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Steve. Well, I'm just too focused on my own problems, sorry, which is very selfish, but at a certain point, yeah.
Okay, that's okay.
I mean, not really. I just it really, I mean, to bring it back, like I was thinking this morning about how, like, I have a platform of a kind, and I think. Like, do I have any power in the world? And if I do, I don't, I really frankly don't know how to use it beyond trying to help people in the way I normally do. I wish that I had political power, but I don't seem to. And so I as a, in my work, I will do what I can to help people. Ne I never want to suggest that we use spirituality as an escape from the world, but I also recognize that without a spiritual practice, the world's problems become overwhelming. And so I have to find a balance between, managing my nervous system and my sanity and being engaged and considering what it is that my engagement means. It doesn't mean doom scrolling. It doesn't accomplish anything. But it also, for me, again, this is why there's just like juggling to me. It's like, but it also means I don't like ignore it. So yeah, my heart's breaking and my heart's broken many times in my life, and so I'll keep putting it back together.
Well, you have a platform and that's what you're doing. And I love you for it. So thank you for all
Yeah.
you.
All right. I was going to close things, but I see that Tenzin has raised their hand, so I will.
Oh, hi.
Bye.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. So, Kevin, I'm so glad this is my first time on this meeting. And, recovery and Buddhism are the two hubs of my life. So I'm just really excited to have found you and, different groups. Yeah, and I'm in San Diego right now on my way back from Mexico. And I hope you'll feel really better soon. But yeah, I was hoping to see you. So I'm glad that I found this today. But
Beautiful.
I did want to mention, so yesterday I read, so Norman Fisher, when Trump was elected, wrote just a brief paragraph of a message that on that day or so after. And I was just trying to copy it and put it, but I'm on my phone, so I can't, but probably you can find it. I read it again yesterday, and it was so helpful and healing, and yeah, there's a lot to learn, and we keep moving forward, helping others every second where we can, and one step at a time. But it was a helpful thing to read again,
Yeah.
so just called, I think, message. Yeah.
Thank
So
you. Thank you. I'll look for that. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe you can post it for everybody or
Yeah.
something. But may you feel better soon. And thank you, everyone, for being here. I'm so glad to be in San Diego for just another 12 hours. Then I fly back to the East Coast. Hold on. Yeah.
All right, stay warm.
Yeah, right.
All right, everybody. Thank you. And another week, and one never knows what will happen to any of us. But let us at least try to bring heartfulness and care into the world, at least in our connections and interactions with others and with ourselves. So, may all beings be free from suffering. Blessings.
Thank you, Kevin.
Okay, guys.
Thank you,
Thank you,
Kevin.
Kevin, and
Monica,
everyone. Take care of
thanks.
yourself.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. Feel better.
All right, Mike.